We turn over in our Bibles this evening the book of Judges. Congregation, beloved of the Lord, the chapters before us tonight may be broken up quite naturally into four distinct parts for ease of study. So I'm going to suggest that we do it that way. And let's look at these four parts together tonight. The first part I want you to notice in chapter 7, the first 15 verses. This gives us Israel's preparation for battle against the Midianites. But it's not at all what we might expect that it would be. Gideon, you remember, had twice tested the Lord with this business of the fleece. First he wanted it wet, and then he wanted it dry. And in each case, the Lord gave him precisely what it was he asked for. That is, the Lord our God condescended in his grace to this particular request so that Gideon could have no excuse but to do what he was told. Well, now the Lord himself, in turn, twice tests Gideon and his soldiers. What happens in this test? Well, the thing is that Israel has too many fighting men, and the Lord doesn't want that. Oh, but wait a moment. The Midianites outnumber the Israelites by a ratio of more than 4 to 1. How then can it possibly be said that Israel has too many fighting men? Well, that's a good question, of course. And it's not as if we're not given the answer, because in this passage we are. If Israel should win, everyone will surely say, and Israel herself will say, that she did this herself. Isn't that how we respond to something? So here is the double test. In the first test, all those who were afraid to fight, some 22,000 men, were permitted to leave the camp. But still there were too many who remained. In the second test, all those who got down on their knees and lapped the water from the stream with their tongues, they too were dismissed. And what did this leave? It left only 300 of the best and bravest soldiers. What kind of fighting power was that against so vast an army of the Midianites? This pruning of the ranks must have seemed rather severe to Gideon. He went to the Midianite camp, and he wasn't disappointed. He discovered, at least among the fighting men themselves, as they talked with one another, he discovered just how afraid the Midianites were to go up against Gideon. He discovered how convinced they were that they were going to lose. They couldn't possibly win against Israel. And thus greatly encouraged himself, more confident now than ever before, that God was able to supply his tiny band of soldiers with all that they needed. Gideon praised the Lord. He worshipped him, we're told, and he prepared to lead his men, though there be but 300 of them, into battle. Now, when we look at something like this, you might wonder, well, what could we possibly learn from something like this? Well, if you ever found a believer, when at last your duty was made clear to you, it's not as if you don't know what to do. Maybe you were wondering before, but now at last it's been made clear. You know what you need to do. And it seemed to you that you were up against a fierce enemy, one with seemingly irresistible strength, that all you had to do was to gather more and better intelligence. And once having grasped the true picture, what was really going on, it didn't seem so bad anymore. Believe it or not, that's the way it is with most things that we fear. Most of the things that we fear in this life are never going to happen. So if we would take these things that we fear and simply look further into them, get a better, truer picture of what is really going on, to see the situation for what it really, truly is, many of those same fears would dissipate. They would disappear completely. This is one of the weapons, fear, particularly irrational fear, one of the great weapons of the great deceiver himself, Satan, the devil. He loves to make us fearful. He loves to think that we couldn't possibly go against such odds as these. And so it is he leaves us cowering in the corner. But what we need with Gideon, what we need with Gehazi, and with so many others before us, is just to learn the truth. Just to learn the situation as it really is. Just to learn who is really in control. To learn that greater is he who is in us, beloved of the Lord, than he who is in the world. Well, the second portion here, verses 16 to 22, gives us the battle itself. But again, it's not the battle that we might have expected. Indeed, it could hardly be called a battle at all. Gideon had only 300 men, remember, yet each one with a trumpet and a pitcher with a torch inside appeared to be, to the enemy looking on, the leader of his own well-equipped and ready-for-anything regiment. Now, that's not the way it was at all, but that's how it appeared to the Midianites. Around 10 o'clock, when the middle watch began, the soldiers of Israel moved into position. Of course, it was dark, wasn't it? At the appointed signal, they blew their trumpets, they smashed their pitchers, they waved their torches, and they shouted their battle cry. And what a battle cry it was, one that was sure to achieve its desired effect, one that undoubtedly Gideon thought of when he himself entered the Midianite camp and heard the soldiers talking and what it was they were so afraid of. So this was the battle cry that they were to declare. The sword of the Lord and of Gideon. That's what the Midianites feared. That's what they would hear. And what was the result? The result was panic and total confusion in the Midianite camp. Flailing at each other in the dark, scarcely knowing what to do, the whole army, we read, ran and cried out and fled for their lives. And you know, it would have been an awesome enough sight had the Lord overpowered the enemy with superior numbers and might. But to overcome them, as he did here, with nothing more than the appearance of force, what a psychological advantage that is. Why, this is even more remarkable yet. The lesson then to congregation. As it was again with David before Goliath, and we see here in Gideon coming up against the Midianites, it's a lesson clearly that we still need to learn today. Perhaps it's a lesson that we need to learn especially today, namely that the battle is the Lord's. The battle we face is spiritual, the consequences are eternal, but the governing principle is always the same. Regardless of the outward circumstances, the governing principle is always the same, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord. It's going to be God's victory. It's going to be for his glory. And it's what he's pleased to do on behalf of his people, that all the world may know that there is a God and he delights in his people. Now, this doesn't mean that we can just sit back and do nothing. David still had to use the sling, didn't he? And Gideon's men still had to blow their trumpets and smash their pitchers. God has given to us the means, in other words. God has given to us particular means, and he expects us to use those means. But he has reserved for himself the results. Sometimes, as we see here in the book of Judges, the Lord uses even the least means to accomplish the greatest results. And in doing so, he not only reveals his majesty, his power, and his glory, but he also displays something else. He displays how our sufficiency, the fact that we can do anything, the fact that we can do anything at all, with meaning and purpose and value, is all from him. The Lord's battle, we do what he says, we leave the results to him, and we will never be disappointed. The third part of what we're looking at tonight comes in chapter 7, from verse 23 down to chapter 8, verse 21. And this tells us what happened during these few days of Israel cleaning up on her enemies. Gideon, of course, needed all the help he could get. And so he called back the men who had not been selected the day before. Terrible slaughter ensued. Some 120,000 Midianites were killed. But of special interest here, and a very particular value for us to study carefully, is the manner in which Gideon dealt with opposition. Opposition from certain of his own people. That's right. As in any war, opposition from one's own people can be just as challenging, just as devastating, even more so, as from the enemy. One is always prepared for the enemy, or seeks to be prepared for the enemy, but it's difficult to be prepared for opposition that comes from within one's own camp. It's helpful, therefore, to learn just what to do in a situation like that. And Gideon very wisely shows us how to deal with this kind of opposition that comes from within our own camp. Two problems are recorded for us here. The first problem came from the Ephraimites. they answered Gideon's call for help with great enthusiasm. They wanted to get into the battle. They wanted to be part of it. Nevertheless, they were disappointed. They were very upset that Gideon hadn't called for their help earlier on. And so they criticized him sharply. The Ephraimites were very disappointed in Gideon. Here, why didn't you call for us? We could have helped. We might have done something. In their pride, they never inquired as to why they were overlooked. Had they done so, of course, and had they accepted this explanation, they would have been told that it was the will of the Lord, and that Gideon had no liberty to employ anyone other than these 300 soldiers who had been set apart for service. Gideon's response to the Ephraimites is well worth noting. It's a good example of how a gentle answer turns away wrath. I want you to notice Gideon didn't seek personal vindication. He didn't seek to put the Ephraimites in their place, as we say. On the contrary, he disarmed their contentious spirit by commending them for their contribution, by commending them for their very real contribution, which they had made to the cause. Now, what contribution was this? The Ephraimites captured two of the leading princes in Midian. Now, this was an important feat in itself. It needed to be recognized. Now, someone may say, well, that doesn't really address the problem, does it? The Ephraimites are upset. They're complaining. They're criticizing. They are some angry at Gideon. No, it's quite true. This didn't address the problem at all, but it diffused it. And that's what was so badly needed if the Israelite soldiers were to avert any further trouble among their number at this critical time. Look at chapter 8, verse 3. Then their anger, the anger of the Ephraimites toward him, toward Gideon, abated or subsided when he said that. And oh, congregation, that we might learn to do that same kind of thing, that we might exercise the same attitude and humble spirit in our dealings with contentious brethren, those who would oppose us, those within our own number who would oppose us. Let's not insist on being right, but on setting things right to the glory of God, even if it means being wronged ourselves in the process. Sometimes we just need to humble ourselves, and learning to disarm those who would oppose us can be a far better and more effective way of dealing with the opposition than simply becoming angry in turn and lashing out. The second problem Gideon had to deal with, and one far more serious really than the first, was the rejection that he faced from the people of Succoth and Penuel. At both places, you'll notice, Gideon asked for food for his men. He asked for food for his soldiers, who were by this time so very tired and hungry. Now, that's not an unreasonable request, is it? Especially from the head of government, the commander-in-chief, in a time of war. As a matter of fact, this is a perfectly reasonable thing. One would expect to be asked something like this. If one's soldiers were traveling in a certain territory and they're tired and hungry, it's not reasonable that the people of that territory should look after them in whatever way they can. And yet it was in these cities a request that was met with contempt. They didn't want to have anything to do with it. So Gideon vowed to deal with them harshly, which is exactly what he did when he returned in triumph over their enemies. The question arises, though, why did Gideon treat Succoth and Penuel so severely when he had been so generous and so understanding toward the men of Ephraim? What a different response, an altogether opposite response. Gentle to the one and harsh to the other. Why was that? Well, that's a good question. And it's surely important that we seek to answer that question with some measure of discernment. And here it is. Although the Ephraimites were quite wrong in their criticism of Gideon, nevertheless, they were committed to the cause, weren't they? There's no question that the Ephraimites were committed to the cause. They were willing to fight, so they weren't able to. So they were told no. They weren't even asked in the first place. But they were certainly committed to the cause. The people of Succoth and Penuel, on the other hand, committed acts of treason against God and his people. They're refusing to provide food for Gideon's men, for their own army, after all. when it was so desperately needed, was the ultimate defiance of authority. There's no place for this. No place for this at all. And thus Gideon was entirely right to impose the very penalties, the very harsh penalties that he had passed against them. That's not sour grapes that we're looking at here. That's not the kind of thing this is about at all. It's not a fit of uncontrolled rage on Gideon's part, not for a moment. It's an act rather of justice on the part of the civil magistrate, whom the Bible calls God's minister and avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. And it must surely be said that what the people of Succoth and Penuel did, or what they failed to do, was a great evil, a great wickedness, especially in time of war. It was, in fact, an act of treason. Now, the only point I want to bring out here is simply this, that we ought not to regard all opposition as the same, because it isn't. Gideon acted wisely and with due justice in distinguishing, as he did, between the Ephraimites and these other people. We too are sometimes called of God to discriminate, aren't we? We're put into certain situations where we're called to discriminate, to look beyond the mere appearance, and having done that, to act in a way that won't make us popular or even seem fair. Other people will say, well, you're acting inconsistently. You're not doing the same with these people as you are with those. And yet we need to do that, don't we? We're not called to act fairly, that is, to treat everybody in the same way. We're called to act justly. We're called to act righteously. Moreover, we need to pray for our leaders at every level of society that they may have the wisdom and courage to do that as well. One of the things we pray for, as we're called in the scriptures to pray for our leaders, is to pray that they might have this kind of wisdom. The fourth and final portion of this present narrative, you find it in chapter 8, verses 22 to 28. And here we see the aftermath of the Midianite battle. The aftermath of the battle. And along with that, just how vulnerable we can be right after, immediately after, we have achieved the greatest victories. When are we as a people most vulnerable? Is it before a battle, or is it after a battle? I suppose most of us would think by nature, when we're most vulnerable is before a battle. And it's true, we may be very vulnerable because with our hands hanging down and with feeble knees, our knees are knocking together, we're scared to death, we see ourselves as being very vulnerable. But in point of fact, we're more vulnerable after the battle, especially if we've achieved a great victory. That's when we're most vulnerable of all. The first example of vulnerability, of people thinking that they're stronger than they really are, is in Israel calling for their new hero, Gideon, to establish a hereditary monarchy. They want him to establish a dynasty. The other nations have it. Why shouldn't we have it too? And what better choice than for Gideon to be our king, and his son after him, and his son after him, will establish a dynasty. This will be a proven thing. We already know that Gideon is able to win great battles. Notice already the people are thinking, in spite of the fact that it couldn't be more obvious in all the world that it's the Lord who has gained for them this victory, they're already thinking of Gideon. Gideon responded to this demand in no uncertain terms. I will not rule over you, he said, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. And what we need to understand here is that it was not wrong for Israel to have a king. I think sometimes when we're thinking about the Old Testament, we're thinking about some of this history, we begin to think that no, Israel wasn't supposed to have a king. In fact, the Lord would later appoint David to be Israel's king. And he in turn, David, would be an important forerunner of the coming Christ, the great king himself, the King of Kings. What was so terribly wrong then was not in Israel having her own king, but in her appointing one. In her insisting on one, because she was no longer satisfied with the theocracy, no longer satisfied with God's own rule, which she already had. And that, you see, was revolution. When you attempt to replace one king with another, that's revolution. Aboard ship, it's called mutiny. And it was to Gideon's credit that he wanted nothing to do with that. Undoubtedly, that was the reason, too, that God blessed Israel on account of a right-thinking judge. And so it was, we're told, that the country was quiet. It was without threat of war for the 40 years of Gideon sitting on the bench. But there's another example here, a second example of vulnerability. And here, surprisingly, it's not with the people, but it's with Gideon himself. It's with Gideon himself. Gideon requested and received some 688 ounces of gold from the plunder of the Midianites. And this he fashioned into an ephod, which was the garment of the high priest when he sought to know the will of God. Now, what exactly Gideon intended to do with this ephod, we can't be sure. But as with all religious paraphernalia, it was subject to superstitious use. And in time, it seems that's exactly what happened. That's what happened here. Verse 27, this ephod of gold became a snare even to Gideon and to the members of his own house. But that wasn't all. We find that Gideon is more vulnerable yet. Another indication of Gideon's weakened state is the evidence of a regal lifestyle on his part. We're told this only in a few words, but it's well worth observing, the kind of thing we need to pick up as we go along. Remember, Gideon refused to be Israel's king, but he wanted the lifestyle that goes with being a king. To be sure, he had refused a crown when it was first offered to him. But over time, how long does it take? Does it take a few years? He accumulated wives and concubines, something which in itself was quite forbidden by Deuteronomy chapter 17. As one writer put it, he assumed the style, if not the title, of an Oriental monarch. Now, what can we learn from all this? Not just this last part, but looking back over the whole passage, this whole incident, the manner in which Israel dealt with the Midianites in battle. What can we learn from this? I would like to suggest that there are at least three lessons we can draw from this. Three very practical lessons. Practical for God's people in every generation right down to our own day. Number one, in the midst of victory, with celebration and songs of joy filling the air, men are inclined to the greatest carelessness. It's when everything appears to be going well, when we've just achieved a great victory, when we're celebrating in the streets, not conscious that anything could possibly be wrong. This is when we're vulnerable to the greatest carelessness. Having stood our ground at the front gate, as it were, we now let the devil slip in the back door. And oh, how we need to guard ourselves against that. We need to watch that very carefully, don't we? When everything's going well, that's when we're most vulnerable. Because we're not looking. We're not thinking. We're not considering as we should. And we become very careless. Number two, Gideon was what we call a good man. If ever we might see of anyone that he was a good man, we could say that of Gideon. And I don't doubt that he was a true servant of the Lord. If there should be any doubt in anyone's mind, Hebrews chapter 11 surely settles that question once and for all. He was a true servant of God. However, even the best of men are not immune to lapses of backsliding, of inconsistency, and even hypocrisy. And Gideon, though he started out so well, had a weak and somewhat disappointing finish. Time and again we see that kind of thing, don't we? And we see it also with Gideon. What a great start. What great things the Lord was pleased to accomplish through this man, and yet we see in the waning years something that isn't quite right, and it's not as it should be at all. How much better it would be, even if someone starts out very poorly, to finish well, and to keep pressing for the goal, for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ. What of the man who boasts that he started out so well? It doesn't matter how we start out. Where are we now in our walk with the Lord? How are we doing? Are we seeking to walk a closer walk with the Lord? Are we seeking to be more faithful and fruitful than what we've been? Are we looking ahead rather than back and praying that we might have the grace to finish well? And then number three, the men of Israel wanted Gideon to be their king. Yet Gideon is himself a good example of why we must not put our trust in princes, nor in any mortal man in whom there is no help. What's the Bible say of the kings of the earth? His breath is in his nostrils. In the very day he dies, his plans perish with him. Let us trust rather in the Lord. Oh, congregation, if we learn anything from this passage at all, surely it's that. There's a call here to trust in the Lord. He is the great I Am. He is the everlasting God who changes not. Whoever believes in him will not be disappointed. Whoever commits all that he has and is to the true and living God, he will not be put to shame. Whoever calls on the Lord, the Bible says, shall be saved. Whoever calls upon him in truth, whoever waits upon the Lord, shall renew his strength. He will mount up with wings as eagles. He shall run and not be weary. He shall walk and not faint. How is it that we start off every service of worship? It's always with this one text, isn't it? Our help is in the name of the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. And that's the very thing we need constantly to be reminded of, not only in our services of worship, but in everything we do, that we're looking to the Lord, leaning not on the arm of flesh, but relying solely on the Lord himself, seeking to serve him with the wisdom and strength and all the gifts and graces that he's pleased to give, that in the end the Lord himself might be honored for it.